From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs has surprised and delighted many fans, except for those who happen to live in San Jose. This week on Only a Game, what will it take to get the Sharks out of shallow water? And cashing in on quarterback fever during Sunday's NFL draft. Also ahead, director James Toback explains why his new documentary of Mike Tyson's life does not represent reality.
I'm not suggesting that this is the truth. I'm saying this is Mike Tyson's version of the truth. So that if I were presenting you with Gauguin's self-portrait, I would not say to you, this is what a photograph of Gauguin looks like. This is Gauguin's painting of himself.
Well, we're glad to get that straightened out. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In at least one of the NBA playoff games last night, surprise was not a factor. LeBron James knocked down 25 points and collected 10 rebounds to lead the Cleveland Cavaliers over the Detroit Pistons 79-68. Many of the experts expect the Cavaliers, who now lead that series 3-0, to advance to the finals this spring. They'll have an opportunity to sweep the Pistons out of the postseason when the two teams meet again in Detroit tomorrow. The 36 points Dwight Howard scored for the Orlando Magic last night were trumped by the layup Thaddeus Young hit for the Philadelphia 76ers with just 2 seconds left in the game. Young put the underdog Sixers over the top 96-94 and gave Philadelphia a 2-1 lead in that series, in which the Magic had been favored. Philadelphia got away with missing 7 of 11 free throws late in that game. In another close one, the Houston Rockets beat the Portland Trail Blazers 86-83 to take a 2-1 lead in their series. Houston will host Game 4 tomorrow. Having been double-teamed throughout the series, Houston center Yao Ming said, "It's tough for me, almost like a sandwich." I don't know why that strikes me as so poignant. Finally, it looked last night as if the Rangers were a bunch of saps. They gave up 4 unanswered goals and couldn't catch the Caps. So Washington, once all but finished, lives to play once more. You must score 5 to beat a team that gets as much as 4. The Rangers leading that Stanley Cup playoff series 3-2 and coached by a man who threw a water bottle into the stands last night will try to close out the Capitals tomorrow in New York. The San Jose Sharks entered the Stanley Cup playoffs with a number one seed and 4 players with championship rings on their roster. Tonight, they could be out in the first round, courtesy of the Anaheim Ducks. What went wrong? Mark Purdy is a columnist for the San Jose Mercury News, and he joins me now on the line from San Jose. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
In yesterday's column, after the Sharks' 4-0 loss in Game 4, you said that the Sharks have officially entered the Disney theme park attraction No Tomorrowland.
Yes.
Tell me some of the things that made Thursday's loss so demoralizing.
Well, these last 5 years, the Sharks have had a very good hockey team. And in those 5 years, they have been the higher-seeded team going into every one of their playoff series. And they, at least when they get to the second round in the past, and have lost. And so this year when they won the President's Trophy, which I don't know, the way the Sharks are playing it, I think it was Warren G. Harding was the president. But they, you know, said, well, this is it. We finally got it figured out. We had the best record in the league. Here we go, rock and roll. And then Thursday night in Anaheim was the least intimidating playoff atmosphere I've ever been at. The game wasn't sold out. The people in Orange County, I don't know, you know, most of them were out, I don't know, using their weed eaters or something because they weren't renting the building. The ones that were not really loud. It was a perfect setup for the Sharks to go skate in, tie up the series, come back to San Jose, kind of get on a roll. Some of the younger players on the team just were invisible on Thursday night. And the Anaheim Ducks are a good team, but the Sharks did beat them 4 out of 6 times this year. There's no reason they should put a performance on the ice the way they did Thursday night.
After losing in the second round for the third straight year last year, the Sharks brought in a new coach, Todd McClellan, a few Stanley Cup veterans, an offense-heavy playbook, lots of changes. Everyone agrees they're a better team than they were last year, so shouldn't they at least make it to the second round this time around?
Absolutely, you know, and there was a thought that because they started out of the gate, they were terrific out of the gate. I think they had the NHL's third best ever start to a season. They just kind of got in cruise control, and I understood that argument, and I wondered about it myself. But toward this, in the second half of the season, there were like games they played when against like other really good teams, including the Bruins. You know, they came into Boston and they played very well that night and beat the Bruins in Boston. And so I thought, okay, well, that's the team that we can see in the playoffs. But what constitutes failure? Failure and disappointment are two different things. And I said, well, it'll be a failure if this Sharks team doesn't get to the conference championship series against Detroit, and that'll be, and then we'll see what happens. But if they lose in the first round, this will be the worst, easily the most disappointing result the Sharks would have.
You mentioned that San Jose has been quite supportive of the Sharks and, as you said, taken them to their heart. But how long does that support last if this playoff failure string continues?
There is a love affair from San Jose to this team just because they've been here since 91, and were as Silicon Valley grew, they grew as a franchise. But it'll become more like, I think, Cubs fans, you know, where, okay, we'll go there, have a beer. We're not going to raise our hopes because we don't want to be disappointed again, but we'll go and have a good time and have fun, and that'll be it.
The editors at ESPN, the magazine, apparently anticipating consistent performance in the playoffs by the Sharks, published recently a few of their favorite digs on the team. My favorite was, what do the Sharks and the Titanic have in common? And the answer is, they both look good until they hit the ice. Do you have a favorite dig?
I do have a favorite this year, and that is every team's marketing department does a marketing campaign, right? And the Sharks marketing campaign this year was 23 men, one mission. So I've extended that, and this year it's 23 men, one mission, one round. That's it, you know. And I don't think the marketing department planned on this either. So.
Well, is the marketing department going to be stuck with it because there's a game tonight? Do the Sharks prolong this series, i.e. their misery, for a little longer, or does it end?
I think the Sharks will win tonight at home. They're at HP Pavilion. It's a loud place to play. It's a fun place. It's a really fun experience. And the team generally plays better at home. They only lost five games in regulation this year. They only were shut out twice all season. They've already been shut out twice in the series. But they do play better at home. And I think the Sharks will win tonight and then go to Anaheim on Monday night and lose the series there.
Mark Purdy is a columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Mark, thanks very much for joining me.
Anytime.
The Sharks' downstate rivals, the Anaheim Ducks, became the first California team to hoist Lord Stanley's Cup 2 years ago, but there are still kids in Southern California who've never been to an ice rink. To that end, the Ducks have sponsored a permanent exhibit at the Discovery Science Center in Santa Ana called The Science of Hockey. KPCC's Susan Vallett has the story.
The thousands of maroon seats that surround the ice at the Honda Center in Anaheim are empty. The lights buzz softly above. Anaheim Ducks defenseman Francois Beaujamet, who helped the Ducks win the 2007 Stanley Cup, is on the deserted ice, cranking out some wicked slap shots during a workout late in the regular season. Beaujamet uses the science of hockey each time he's out here, but he's never taken a shot at the science behind it.
Playing hockey all my life, and I don't really know what's going on in the angles we're shooting and all that. We do think about angles, but we don't calculate. I mean, what's the angles? The way we're skating, it's all part of science, but I've never really think about it.
The Discovery Science Center hopes its new Science of Hockey exhibit will get the next generation of hockey and non-hockey kids to think about it. The center's Janet Yamaguchi says science is in every aspect of the game. She's on the Ducks bench at the arena as Beaujamet shoots.
So what we can see here is a demonstration of some of Newton's laws of motion. We can see that the pucks that are sitting on the ice right now, they have potential energy there. As he shoots it, he's transferring the kinetic energy in his stick to the puck, and that's what sends it sailing across to get into the goal.
An unbalanced force sends the mass rink wide to Bobby Ryan. He spins the mass 360, and he scores! What a demonstration!
At the Discovery Science Center exhibit, you can hit the announcing booth and call a play like Ducks play-by-play guy Steve Carroll using science terms. A few steps away, you grab a glove, a blocker, and a goalie stick and step in front of a real hockey net. A virtual player skates on the giant screen in front of you and shoots the puck. The foam puck hits the goalie stick with a thud. Stick save! After a few shots, Discovery Science Center Vice President of Education Janet Yamaguchi says it's time to move on.
Here you reverse the position to get a chance to be the shooter. And you'll see our actual duck goalie on the screen. And you're going to try to make goals this time.
Doesn't sound like much, but NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman says the exhibits get kids interested in science and the game of hockey.
The interactivity is great, whether or not you're shooting at a goaltender or you're being the goaltender shot at or you sit in the penalty box and have to answer questions, statistical, mathematical questions under pressure. I mean, it's all a lot of fun. It's all very educational.
The museum says teachers will be able to take lessons back to the classroom. It's the only permanent exhibit of its kind in the country. The ducks were the driving force behind it, and they paid for a lot of it, too. Bettman says the NHL is also a sponsor.
For us, anything that we can do that relates to children connecting to our game and using our game as a positive example is something we want to be involved with.
Bettman's favorite part of the exhibit is where you test your reaction time, something key for both goalies and shooters. The museum's Janet Yamaguchi shows us how it works.
So when you put your hands on these buttons, you can actually select whether you want to receive a stimulus that's light, sound, or vibration. We'll pick sound because sound is just always fun, isn't it?
Bettman jokes he beat Ducks owner Henry Samueli on this, with a reaction time of about 0.3 seconds. Not bad for an average Joe, but an NHL goalie is twice as fast. The Discovery Science Center's Janet Yamaguchi says she wants kids to walk away with a new understanding.
Science really is in everything, and so being able to look at hockey from that point of view is a really fun challenge.
That challenge is open to the public as the Ducks battle to advance in the 2009 playoffs, something kids can imagine themselves doing at the Science of Hockey exhibit. For Only a Game, I'm Susan Vallett in Los Angeles.
Congratulations! We hope you enjoy your visit to the Science of Hockey exhibit at Discovery Science Center.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Step lively. John Longmire will be doing that. Pick up the beat. You can count on Mr. Longmire to comply. He'll be running the Country Music Marathon in Nashville today, and he'll be playing the banjo for all 26.2 miles while raising money for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. It's not going to be my best playing, Longmire said this week. I'm having to keep my playing to very simple things. Mr. Longmire estimates the banjo gig will add at least an hour to the time he ran in last year's race. Wouldn't it be cool if he hesitated at the finish line to finish whatever song he was playing? I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, refugees from many nations pursue one goal. Well, actually, a lot of goals. But first, the stock market will be closed, but values will still rise and fall. Deals will be made. There will be plenty of speculating, and everyone will be hoping for big returns on their investments. Today and tomorrow are the NFL's draft days. And joining me now to prognosticate about potential picks is Mike Reese of the Boston Globe. Mike, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here.
Drafting the right quarterback can put a team on the road to success. Drafting the wrong one can start an avalanche, a tailspin that lasts for several seasons. In an article published this week, you wrote about the risks of selecting quarterbacks in the first round. Tell us a little bit about what your research revealed.
Sure. We started in 1990 and looked at every quarterback selected in the first round of the NFL draft and basically determined that less than 50% of those quarterbacks became the great player that the teams that picked them hoped that he would be. So it has sort of a conflict there. It's you need the quarterback to win big in the NFL, but when you're picking one in the first round, there's no guarantee that's the right guy.
Last year, the Detroit Lions became the first NFL team to lose all 16 of their regular season games. They have the first selection in tomorrow's draft, and they're expected to choose University of Georgia quarterback Matthew Stafford. Shouldn't they get a couple, maybe three picks before the first round even begins?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the reason they're going for a quarterback is that in the last 51 years, they've only had one quarterback that was selected to the Pro Bowl, which is the All-Star game for football. And they hope that Matthew Stafford will double that number in due time.
Well, give me your best educated opinion. Is Matthew Stafford the guy who can come out and do that?
They need a lot more help than just him. They have a new coach out there in Detroit, and Jim Schwartz, a bright young coach, and I think they will put the players around him. And to me, it is the choice that you should make if you're in the first position and you think that the quarterback is the right player. I think that he is the right choice.
There's a danger with something like that is you put a young kid in that situation. There's a danger, I would think, that he would not only be discouraged, but that he might get hurt.
It's a great point, and these teams need to make a very important decision, and it's do we put this quarterback in right away, or do we keep him on the sidelines for a year, maybe 2 years, get the players better around him, and then maybe he's ready to step under center.
And then, of course, you have the wonderful risk of fans screaming, having paid top prices for tickets, where the heck is this guy that you paid all that money for?
That's right, but in Detroit, those fans have paper bags over their heads, so you can't really hear them.
Muffled screaming in Detroit. The only other quarterback generally viewed as a lock to be chosen in the first round is USC's Mark Sanchez. What makes him so attractive to NFL teams?
Well, part of it is that he played at Southern California, one of the big college programs, and I think teams like players with that big pedigree. But there's a danger with him, and he's only started 16 games at the college level, and I think usually, you know, teams like to see extensive starting experience. As an example, the San Diego Chargers picked Philip Rivers in the first round in 2004. He had 51 career starts in college. So there's a lot of good in Mark Sanchez. He has sort of that cool Tom Brady-like approach. On the flip side, have teams seen enough to accurately assess his talent?
Mike, I want to move to a different kind of story altogether. Earlier this month, Sports Illustrated reported on its website that Boston College defensive tackle B.J. Raji had failed a drug test at the NFL Combine back in February. This week, Sports Illustrated retracted that story. Raji has been projected, or had been projected, as a top 10 pick. I wonder if the impact of the story, now Sports Illustrated admits it's inaccurate, what that impact will be in terms of when he's chosen in the draft?
I think it's a great question, and there's so many areas we can talk about with it, but in terms of how it might affect B.J. Raji, I don't think it will affect him, and here's the reason why. When we talked about how much money these players are receiving at the top of this draft, these NFL teams do extensive research, background research, talk to a lot of people to make sure they have the right information. So while that report came out and maybe influenced public perception of B.J. Raji, I think the NFL perception is already well set in stone from that research that these teams do.
Two other players have also been linked to marijuana this week, according to FoxSports.com. Florida wide receiver Percy Harvin and North Carolina wideout Brandon Tate both tested positive for the drug back in February. Harvin was expected to go in the first round, Tate perhaps as early as the second round. What do teams do now? Wait and hope to get these guys cheaper because their value has fallen in later rounds?
I think the first thing they do is they try to determine if this is a one-time event or if it's just a pattern of a bigger thing. And, you know, the other part is these players know that they were going to be tested. They knew they were going to be tested in February, and the fact they came up positive shows bad judgment. So these teams need to make a decision and say, did this player do this knowing this and it's just is reckless and we don't want to pay him this money? Or, you know, is it a one-time thing? So they might say, oh, it's a one-time thing. We can maybe get a bargain if he slips down in the draft.
All right, which teams do you think are in the best position to significantly improve themselves with selections tomorrow?
I would look at the teams with two first-round draft choices, and that's the Denver Broncos with the 12th overall pick and the 18th overall pick, the Buffalo Bills at number 11 and number 28. So you have two teams there with multiple first-round picks, and usually that's the highest percentage of getting the best player.
And beyond the quarterbacks, two of whom at least we've already discussed, who do you look for as very high picks?
It's interesting because every team has a different style of play, so what might look good for one team might not look good for another, but a couple of players to keep in mind in this draft are offensive linemen, these big tackles, 6'6", 300-pound guys, Jason Smith out of Baylor, Eugene Monroe out of Virginia, Andre Smith out of Alabama, Michael Orr out of Mississippi, had a book written about him, The Blind Side, so I think these big players are in line for some big money.
All right, just one last question, Mike, and that has to do with the phenomenon that over the years has grown up around draft day. I first became aware of it in terms of the New York Giants football team, where their fans would gather, and they seemed determined to scream and shout their dismay no matter who the Giants picked. Has that spread throughout the league?
It really has, and it is. I think it's passed sort of the casual fan by, and it's almost like its own little industry. You have some fans who say, you know, I can't keep up with it, just tell me who the team picks and how he fits, and let's move on. And others say, I want to know more. I want to know who they're visiting with, who they're working out, who they're scouting. So you have two different worlds here, and it really is amazing to me how this has grown.
Mike Reese covers the National Football League for the Boston Globe. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Anybody coaching a youth team will have challenges. Kids whose parents think they should be playing more or playing another position. Kids who forget to come to practice with their equipment. Kids who forget to come to practice. But how about trying to coach a team made up of youngsters who speak about 10 different languages? Youngsters who have in common only their poverty and their status as refugees. That was the challenge Luma Mufla faced coaching the Fugees. Warren St. John has written about Coach Luma in his new book, Outcasts United, A Refugee Team, An American Town. He joins me now from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Warren, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
We will get to the stories of some of the refugee children that Coach Luma Mufla coached, but first, tell me a little bit about her background, since Luma was something of an outcast herself, at least as far as her family in Jordan was concerned.
That's right. Luma is from Amman, Jordan. She's the daughter of a well-to-do Jordanian family. Her father went to college in the U.S. She went to Western schools in Amman and then attended Smith, the women's college in Northampton, Massachusetts. And after Smith, she decided that she liked life in the United States. She liked the opportunity for women in particular, and she felt her life in Jordan would be prescribed and she'd have to follow a very rote path. So she told her parents she was going to stay in the United States, and they were deeply hurt, deeply offended by this, and disowned her. So she was not a refugee in the way that her players were, but she was certainly severed from the world that she knew and felt comfortable with and was sort of set adrift in the U.S. to find a life here.
Describe for us Luma's coaching philosophy.
Personal responsibility is paramount. Self-reliance is important. It's a cornerstone of what she asks of her players. And the work ethic is intense. Luma's one of these people who, if she tells her team to meet at 8 a.m. To get on the bus to go to an away game, she's there at 7:55, and she does this consistently. And for kids, it's interesting. It's a very reassuring thing to have someone in their lives who is totally predictable, who always does what he or she says she's going to do. And the players like it and respond to it and start to sort of absorb this mode of being.
Once Coach Luma had begun to organize these teams of refugees, different age groups of kids into teams, who came up with the idea that they should be called the Fugees?
It's funny. The name is it's of uncertain origin. No one really remembers exactly when it was applied or who came up with it. And it was sort of a nickname at first, of course, Fugees being short for refugees. And at some point along the way, as Luma registered her team for league play, she had to call them something. And and so she wrote down Fugees, and now that the name has stuck.
You write of these kids who were divided into the 13 and unders, the 15 and unders, and the 17 and unders that, quote, they sensed that they were underdogs and connected with each other over the prospect of evening the score once the whistle blew. Tell me about the specific ways in which some of these youngsters were underdogs and how they hoped to even the score.
In the most basic sense, these are very economically challenged families. Refugees from Africa and the Middle East typically arrive with nothing but the clothes on their backs. And in fact, they often arrive in debt because they have to repay the cost of the one-way tickets to the United States. And there's another very sort of persistent challenge that the kids face, and that is just trying to figure out where they fit in this new world. If a kid from, say, Liberia or Congo goes to the local public school, the kids in that public school, most of them may have never heard of the country where this child came from. The child may have an accent of some kind. They get teased for that. They have cultural habits and customs that the other kids don't understand. So they're sort of thought of as other and outside the norm at school, where, of course, like kids everywhere, they want to fit in. They want to be accepted by their peers. Then if they sort of adapt some of the Americanisms, maybe they untuck their shirt, maybe they start talking like Americans, and they go home, their mother says, "We can't dress like that in Africa. What are you doing? Or we don't wear our hair like that in Africa. You need to uphold our traditions and our way of living." And so wherever they go, they're not quite accepted or on the inside. And because of that, the Fugees became this very secure place for the boys, where because everybody's from a different country, there is no normal that you have to constantly try to appeal to. You just accept that everyone is radically different from the next person. And that's a very evening sort of proposition.
Besides the issues her players brought to the team, Luma had to deal with a town that was at best ambivalent about the presence of thousands of refugees in general and several youth soccer teams in particular. How did she deal with those attitudes?
The town of Clarkston was designated a resettlement center, and in the span of a little over a decade, the town went from being a basically homogenous, sort of down on its luck southern town, to having a third to a half of its residents from around the world. They're students from over 50 countries at the Clarkston High School, just to give a sense of the radical change. And a lot of the older residents woke up really almost unaware that this process was happening until it was too late for them. Their whole town had been transformed. So some left, and others stayed and adjusted and reached out. And then still others stayed and were quite bitter about everything that had happened. And soccer, being the international game, particularly soccer played by refugees who look different from the locals, really became a symbol of all the change that had happened in Clarkston. And there was a sort of backlash against the game of soccer itself because it was seen as evidence of how much the town had changed.
I'm talking with Warren St. John, author of Outcasts United, and you're listening to Only a Game. I want you to read a passage from Outcasts United just to give our listeners a sense of how Luma's efforts sometimes panned out. You're writing about a particular practice where Luma is concentrating on the under-17s, but she can't help but notice what the more or less unsupervised under-13s are up to.
Sure. On Wednesday, though, as Luma was watching her under-17 team scrimmage, she looked over to see the 13s running together in a kind of chorus line. The faster players had slowed down for the slower players, who in turn had sped up so as not to hold their teammates back. They ran like this quietly for 15 minutes or so, at which point the boys began to clap in rhythm with their strides. Eventually, the boys initiated a call-and-response chant. "Who are the kings?" someone would shout to the group in time. "The Fugees," the team would answer. Luma remained focused on the older boys' scrimmage, but the 13s wouldn't be ignored. They chanted louder with each pass until Luma finally turned around to see what the fuss was all about. When the 13s saw they had their coach's attention, someone else called out, "Who is the queen?" "Luma," the boys shouted. When Luma shook her head to convey her befuddlement, the boys tumbled to the ground in laughter. It was a small, ridiculous moment, but also a sign of more significant developments. Boys from 13 different countries and a wide array of ethnicities, religions, and languages were creating their own inside jokes. Even Muhammad Muhammad, the Iraqi Kurd whose family had arrived in the United States only a few months before the season and who spoke almost no English at all, was chanting at the top of his lungs and laughing as if someone had just told him the funniest joke he'd ever heard.
To what extent does the experience of the Fugees work as a model beyond youth soccer in suburban Georgia?
I found that the story of the Fugees in Clarkston was, to me, incredibly inspiring and motivating because it showed really the best things about our country and our culture, our ability to selflessly help other people, and the American capacity to improvise one's way out of the most complex social situations. Clarkston, Georgia is just, by all measures, a sort of social train wreck. People from this many places should never be able to communicate and function and get along, and yet it's happening. And that's what the book is about, is how that process came to be.
Warren St. John is the author of Outcasts United, a refugee team in American town published by Spiegel and Grau. He spoke to me from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Warren, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been fun.
You're listening to Only a Game.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decorative Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decordiva.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For the Washington Nationals, the first major league team to lose 10 games this spring, everything that can go wrong has been going wrong, including the lettering on some of their jerseys. On Tuesday, Adam Dunn and Ryan Zimmerman of the Nationals took the field in uniform shirts that read, "Nationals." They played in the shirts missing the O's for three innings, eventually changing when somebody located ones with the correct spelling. Majestic Athletic, the company that supplies Washington's jerseys, took full responsibility and apologized. "We regret the embarrassment," their statement read. But the company maintained that they were not responsible for the result of the game, which the one-time Nationals lost to the Florida Marlins 3-2. T-W-O.
That is incorrect. Wrong. Try again. That is incorrect. Wrong. Try again.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a film in which Mike Tyson speaks for himself with no interruptions. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
There's not enough popcorn in the world to make me go to that film.
All right, so much for home court advantage. The Boston Celtics traveled to Chicago on Thursday night and handed the Bulls a loss by 21 points. So, should we just recrown the champs?
Well, they handed them more than a defeat. They handed them their hindquarters in front of their... No, this will still be a very interesting series, but this was a very, very serious wake-up call to the Bulls, who got defended out of this game in the first quarter and never caught up. The Celtics will beat the Bulls. They will probably do so in six games, I think. What happens after that is anybody's guess, given their injuries. Chicago's had a nice run, but that was a signifying moment the other night.
The Utah Jazz will try to even their series against the L.A. Lakers tonight at home. The Lakers lost the last home game on a nail-biter. They needed six tough games to knock the Jazz out of the second round last year. So, should we worry about Kobe at all?
A little bit, I think. I thought this one was over because the last time I saw these two teams play, Utah would get the lead down to about 4 or 5 points, and L.A. would have it back up to 13 without breaking a sweat. Carlos Boozer, the Utah Jazz, really asserted himself in the middle and really made Pau Gasol a defensive liability, which is pretty much what the Celtics did last year, too. I think this is going to be a better series than I thought it was going to be a week ago.
Also tonight, the Dallas Mavericks will try to take a 3-1 lead against the San Antonio Spurs. Earlier this week, the NBA declined to punish Mavs center Eric Dampier for saying he intended to put Spurs star Tony Parker, quote, on his back. What would Eric Dampier have had to say in order to get the league's attention?
I have no idea, but this would be. But if he actually did this, it would be more energy than Eric Dampier has shown in his entire NBA playoff career prior to this moment.
The playoffs are over for Dikembe Mutombo of the Houston Rockets. In fact, Mr. Mutombo's career is over thanks to a knee injury that the 18-year NBA veteran suffered in Tuesday night's game. Long and distinguished as his career has been, what are the chances that he'll be remembered for something bigger than basketball?
Well, he's the first person to win the NBA Citizenship Award twice. He's opened a $29 million hospital in Kinshasa, and he's donated approximately $19 million. He's raising himself. He's a remarkable man of the world. I hope he stays in this country and is an ambassador for all that's good about sports, because he's already got a great head start on that.
All right, Charlie, you're a basketball player, and former sneaker company executive Sonny Vaccaro says that your best career move is to go pro. And what do you do? Well, the answer is, if you're 17-year-old Jeremy Tyler, you drop out of high school. Good move.
This is bound to happen. I'm sure the European leagues will at some point decide to put the lid on this, but right now it's the Wild West over there. The NBA no longer allows high school players to come directly into the NBA draft. As soon as you shut off that avenue, kids who don't necessarily want to go to college, much less play in college, are going to find some other place to go. I suspect that, as I said, I think Europe will shut off this avenue fairly quickly.
Jeremy Tyler had a particularly interesting rationalization for his decision. He said, you know, college is not the place to go to get better as a basketball player. I'm going to play against the pros in Europe. That's what's going to make me better. Do you buy that?
Well, I think that if he's realizing that the only reason he would be going to college is to learn to be a better basketball player, it's remarkably clear-sighted of him, and I congratulate him on his decision. I hope he's got a support staff for him over there, because he really will be walking into adulthood with his eyes closed if he doesn't.
Although the New York Yankees may have thought they were building a new baseball stadium, they have apparently built instead a wind tunnel conducive to many home runs. Or were the early stats out of the Bronx, i.e. 26 home runs in the first six games, a fluke?
It's possible it might be an early season fluke. It's possible when the weather gets warm and the pitchers get better, this will settle down. It's really been remarkable, though. 26 home runs at the stadium through Friday night's games is really quite something.
Forbes magazine reported this week that 10 Major League Baseball teams have declined in value. Guess which teams aren't among them?
Boston, L.A., and the Chicago Cubs. But the most remarkable number of this is the Washington Nationals, who I wouldn't have given you 85 cents for, were down 12% and were still worth $406 million.
Well, that's assuming you could find somebody who had $406 million to pay
for them. Exactly
right. Tonight, the first pitch at the Mets-Nationals game will be thrown by 12-year-old Mackenzie Brown. What did Ms. Brown do to deserve that honor?
She retired 18 opposing batters, all of them boys, I would point out, and a perfect game for the Bayonne Little League, and good for her.
Fans of parity in the National Football League will be happy to learn that this week the Detroit Lions have figured out how to improve from 0-16. New logo. How do you like that strategy?
You said fans of parody or parody?
What are we talking about? I meant parody. I'm not sure quite what I said. The ITY word.
The ITY word is okay. The ODY is much more appropriate. Yes, I think to make up for a decade's worth of really bad organizational work and really bad drafting, putting teeth on the lion is really going to turn things around.
A more fierce lion logo should do the job. Earlier this month, SI.com reported that B.J. Raji was among the college football players who had failed a drug test. Charlie, Tuesday, SI.com acknowledged that earlier report was wrong. How high does Mr. Raji have to go in the draft for SI.com to avoid a lawsuit?
I hope high enough that he can afford a really good lawyer. I am really tired of this stuff happening at the Combine. These tests are supposed to be confidential. I'm sick and tired of general managers and sub-general managers and scouts and whatever bottom feeders these reporters talk to are leaking, and I hate to use that word in this context, but it's true, letting the information out and smearing people, whether or not they happen to be positive tests or not. Frankly, this was a negative test. I hope B.J. Raji owns SI.com this time next year.
The LPGA announced this week that the Corning Classic, which has been played at the same venue and sponsored by the same company for 30 years, will cease to exist in May. Also this week, a bicycle race in Philadelphia that's drawn hundreds of thousands of fans in the past appeared to be on the brink of disappearing. Is this just a sign of the times or a sign of the relative weakness of women's golf and cycling among various sports?
It's more a sign of the times. It's these little events, and I don't mean to make the LPGA out to be little, but there's less cash behind it than certainly the men's tour and most major sporting events. So, yeah, things like the bike race in Philadelphia are really going to have a hard time. The Corning Classic is interesting. The Corning Classic is a staple of the women's tour. It existed long before most people knew there was a women's tour. This is a remarkable thing.
And finally, I have to ask you, Mr. NASCAR, how the world's first environmentally friendly racing car made of vegetables and powered by chocolate will be received in your world.
Now, if I were really not Mr. NASCAR and I had a lack of respect, I would point out that this is the first time there are more vegetables in the car than in the stands, but I'm not going to point that out. However, this will be powered. This will be powered by chocolate. And anyone who's attempted to pursue, say, a toddler powered by chocolate knows what a formidable fuel it is.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time right here at Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. And you can visit our website, onlyagame.org.
First question we ask is, who am I? Who am I?
Heavyweight champion of the world.
Voices fighting each other.
Madness.
I can't lose. I refuse to lose.
The makeup of the mind.
I met the president of Chechnya. I met the president of Istanbul. I'm going
to relax. The montage toward the beginning of James Toback's new documentary about former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, an overlap of images and voices, some of which seem to be in the boxer's head, is as intentional as it is confusing, at least according to director Toback.
I think that there is a complexity in his consciousness that you can feel viscerally. I think you feel it in the film. There are shots of his face, very tight shots, and I lay voices, multiple voices over.
Right.
Well, there's a certain presumptuousness there, but I took the liberty of doing that because it seems to represent my notion of who he is and his notion of who he is as he's expressed it to me.
James Toback maintains that he and Mike Tyson share a kind of madness. Toback traces his acquaintance with the voices in his head to one spectacularly bad experiment with LSD during his college days. He claims that it has enabled him to understand some of the boxer's distress. In the documentary, he lets Tyson do all the talking. Some of that talking, as when the boxer attributes his ascent to the heavyweight championship to the influence of Customato, the man who trained and virtually adopted him when Tyson was a teenager, presents Toback's subject in a decidedly sympathetic light.
So I did everything he told me to do, and I won every championship from the amateur championship. I won all the championships. I'm gonna cry. So I won every championship that he told me. Because he told me what to do.
The risk in trusting one subject with all the telling is that said subject will bend that telling to his own advantage. For example, in Tyson, the boxer maintains that he was not guilty of raping Desiree Washington in 1992. A jury said otherwise. In the film, he describes his marriage to Robin Givens as a mistake because, quote, we were just kids. Sounds kind of cute. There is no mention in the film of Tyson's off-sighted claim that the best punch he ever threw was the one with which he knocked Robin Givens across a room and into a wall, an omission that James Toback defends.
No, and I don't know that that's true. It's only one specific reference, which was by Jose Torres in Jose's book about Mike. And I love Jose, loved Jose. He died recently. But you have to take into account the fact that Jose was very bitter and angry at Mike for passing him by as manager. And I don't know that I would take everything that Jose says in that book at face value, including that comment. Mm-hmm. I certainly know that it's odd that Mike supposedly said that to Jose and never to anybody else.
Well, he told me and others that story. It was the greatest punch he ever threw because, you know, it left no fingerprints, but it did the job.
Ron Borges writes about boxing for the Boston Herald and has known Mike Tyson since he began fighting in Golden Gloves tournaments as a teenager.
I wasn't in the room. Givens has certainly told many stories about various forms of abuse that Tyson's never really disputed. And I think the problem you have there with Toback's point of view is like, wait a minute, you don't have any proof. What, because you weren't in the room? I mean, come on. Now, if I choose to do a story and I'm going to only talk to one person and I'm not going to talk to the person who was dangled out the window, then the person doing the dangling, if he or she did that, is probably not going to say, yeah, you know, you're right, I dangled him out the window. So that to me was a big flaw, that one-man approach.
None of this is to suggest that Toback's one-man approach results in recasting Mike Tyson as a saint. The film includes archive footage of Tyson insulting and threatening his opponents and offering to punch out hecklers. The fight during which Tyson twice bit Evander Holyfield in the ear is reprised as well, though Tyson essentially maintains that biting was a legitimate act of self-defense after Holyfield had headbutted him. In his self-defense, director Toback says that it was never his intention to produce an objective history of the rise and fall of Mike Tyson.
I'm not suggesting that this is the truth. I'm saying this is Mike Tyson's version of the truth. So that if I were presenting you with Gauguin's self-portrait, I would not say to you, this is what a photograph of Gauguin looks like. This is Gauguin's painting of himself, you know.
Okay, but Mike Tyson's portrait of himself comes in response to a series of questions from Toback that the audience doesn't hear. So the result is less a Gauguin portrait than a carefully edited paint-by-numbers production by a man who acknowledges that he admires Tyson a great deal. Beyond that, James Toback has an agenda that is not acknowledged in the film. He is part of an effort to rehabilitate Tyson's image so that the ex-champion can find work, perhaps as an endorser of products, perhaps as a marketable celebrity, or, as Toback suggests, perhaps in education, working with kids. Mike Tyson, convicted of rape, among various other crimes, working with kids?
When I say kids, I'm talking about kids who've had backgrounds similar to his own. I don't think that, you know, you would want to start him as the headmaster at Eton. But I think...
I don't think so either.
I think if you take young black kids from the projects who look up to him and who think of him as a kind of iconographic figure and whose backgrounds are close to his own, that he would have a great deal to offer them. And as for the convicted rape question, I certainly can't say anything about it authoritatively because I wasn't there. But I do know that he has always insisted to me that it was absolutely the farthest thing from the truth.
Though he denies the rape charge, Tyson says in the film that he enjoys inflicting pain in intimate situations outside the ring. As an observer who has been meeting with Mike Tyson and writing about him for almost 30 years, Ron Borges warns against swallowing whole the myth of the poor child who made a success of himself despite his deprivations.
You know, it's an interesting thing about his troubled life, and there's no question, you know, he came up in somewhat difficult circumstances. But from 12 years old on, he was living in upstate New York in a very large Victorian house in a place where he had, you know, three good meals in his own room and basically didn't have to follow any rules beyond going to the gym. So how tough was it, you know, compared to a lot of people? He has a brother who went in the Navy, and he was a pharmacist, last I knew, in San Diego. So he seemed to struggle through it somehow without, you know, becoming a social misfit.
While I watched Tyson, I was a little surprised by the reaction of the audience. A woman sitting behind me said she felt sorry for the former champion. She said she felt that now she understood why he'd lashed out so often. In the question and answer session that followed the film, one member of the audience prefaced his question by telling James Toback that he was glad the director had included no voice but Tyson's, since no one else could possibly know the champion's real feelings and his real story. Having heard comments like this from Toback's audience, I wondered what Mike Tyson himself thought of the film.
Well, the first time he saw it, he said, it's like a Greek tragedy. The only problem is I'm the subject. The second time he saw it, he just kind of, I think, enjoyed it in a way he hadn't the first time because it wasn't so raw anymore. The third time was at Sundance, and we had another standing ovation as we had had at Cannes. And at the dinner afterward, he said to me, you know, people have said over the years to me, you know, or I've read them saying that he's crazy and he's dangerous. And he said, I always thought, why are they saying those things about me? Why do they think that? And tonight, for the first time, when I saw the movie, I said to myself, I'm afraid of that guy.
Tyson, the documentary, is presently playing in New York and Los Angeles. The film opens in Chicago and Boston on May 1st. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Brian Fadham, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see my review of Outcast United or listen to stories past or present, please visit onlyagame.org. In our final word, boxing writer Ron Borges does his best impression of Mike Tyson's promoter, Don King.
People say I robbed him. They say I robbed him. Well, if I took 50%, which I didn't, where's the other 50%?
Ah, look in the other pocket, Don. It's there. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.